This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you. So, it's mostly my duty here to introduce a patient and her family, but I wanted to give a little bit of background information. So, I'm a fellow in pediatric gastroenterology at UCSF. During the last year or so, I've had the opportunity to take care of many patients with liver disease and also see general pediatric gastroenterology cases. And one common theme that we've encountered is the lack of therapies aside from liver transplant to treat children with metabolic liver disease. So in general, you know, metabolic liver disease is a relatively rare condition, but adding up all these different diseases together accounts for a significant fraction of children who get liver transplants. About 10% of all liver transplants are done in pediatrics for metabolic liver disease. It's a wide-ranging category. It includes defects in amino acid metabolism, such as maple syrup urine disease, hereditary tyrosinemia, propionic acidemia, methylmalonic acidemia. It includes defects in the urea cycle, so including ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency. It includes defects in glycogen metabolism in people who have glycogen storage diseases. So a common theme to a lot of these diseases is that they'll have metabolic decompensation. So children will have periods where they'll be doing reasonably well, and then they'll have something that trips them over the edge where they go into a catabolic state. They start producing some metabolic byproducts that are highly toxic because they're missing an enzymatic step in amino acid metabolism or carbohydrate metabolism. They can get hyperammonemia, encephalopathy. So in the case of maple syrup urine disease, which is what our patient Vanessa had, she would typically get ketonuria. She would get encephalopathic and have severe metabolic crises, typically associated with illnesses like a common cold. And these can be life-threatening, right? She had to go to the intensive care unit to get intubated. She had to have emergency dialysis done to remove toxic metabolites. The standards of therapy is to limit the intake of branched-chain amino acids. So maple syrup urine disease is caused by a missing enzyme complex called branched-chain keto acid dehydrogenase, which is a complex of several enzymes. Those enzymes metabolize leucine, isoleucine, and valine. And if you're missing that enzyme activity, you develop accumulation of those amino acids. Leucine is especially neurotoxic. And so if it's not treated, it can cause severe brain injury and potentially death. So there's certainly a strong need for improved therapies. We limit, in the case of maple syrup urine disease, intake of branched-chain amino acids. So while you're all enjoying your delicious lunches of chicken and beef, you're taking a lot of these different amino acids. Maybe not so delicious, but fortunately, your livers are able to metabolize those amino acids and shunt them down the appropriate metabolic pathways. But if you happen to be unlucky and you're missing one of those enzymes, you can get really sick right now. So fortunately, Vanessa had a liver transplant. She was lucky enough to be eligible for one, and she had a little bit of a rocky clinical course associated with the liver transplant, which I think they'll probably touch on a little bit. But now she's doing very, very well. So she's one of our success stories from a clinical perspective, and we're very happy and honored to have the family come and talk with us today. But I think the important thing to remember is that the therapies that we have for these diseases are pretty primitive. We understand the metabolic defects that are involved, and so we can approach those from a biochemical perspective and say, you know, we can limit the substrates, you know, that come into these metabolic pathways, but many children still have metabolic decompensations and can have irreversible injury from metabolic decompensation. So something that Dr. Willenbring will hopefully talk about is the potential for cell therapies to be able to provide an alternative, less invasive, less dangerous method of treatment for this variety of diseases. So I'd like to bring up Vanessa and her mother, Veronica. I think the easiest way to do this is kind of just have them to give their perspective. So this is Vanessa Lupien. She's 13 years old. She took the day off of class from school today to come and talk with us, and this is her mother, Veronica.
Hello.
So if I could, would you mind just talking about your experience when she was diagnosed with maple syrup urine disease and what that was like?
Mm-hmm. At first, when Vanessa was born, nobody knew what she had. They knew something was wrong. And after a week, she got admitted into the hospital. And even during that second week that she was there, it still took them time before she was diagnosed because they didn't know what she had. And it wasn't something that newborns were tested for. But finally, after, 2 weeks, 2 weeks of being born, they finally realized that she had MSUD. From that point on, our life completely changed. It hasn't been easy as a family, and it hasn't been easy especially for her. For her to be around food constantly and be something that she could not even have. It was such a big temptation for her. And for us as a family, it was hard to see her just look at us and eat these foods. When she, as growing up, she was very responsible, but she had temptations. And there were times where she would go and hide and because she was wanted to try, whether it was that piece of chocolate candy or, this and that. And, of course, that's where my panic came in. Because I would worry and I would think she is really going to get sick, what's going to happen, and so forth. And there were, since she was born till 10 years old, she was in the hospital once or twice every year. And three or four times of those, we were close to losing her. She had to be taken by ambulance. She had to have dialysis done in order to save her life. And even then, the outcome of it, we were never sure what the outcome was. Thankfully, she made it through it all. The other aspect of living with MSUD was she had to be on a special formula, and a formula that she had to take that we knew would be for the rest of her life. She had to be on a very special diet. The foods that she was able to eat that were very low in protein or no protein at all, they had to be put on a scale. So it's not like she can have the amount that she wanted to have. So even if she wanted more, we couldn't give her more. It was very difficult for her, And having for us to carry around just everything for her to make sure we provided what she needed when we went out and did things with her. When she would get sick, we would start seeing those side effects of her just not wanting to eat, the constant throwing up, and then her being just to the point where she even at times start hallucinating, not knowing who we were. All those points are very scary. We take her to the hospital, and there have been times that when we go to the hospital, the doctors didn't even know exactly what MSUD was. As a parent, that's scary because you go there and you wonder, will they know what to do? They don't know. And so I had to be really on top of things and see what they were doing or what the nurses were giving her and so forth, because it could have made her situation even worse. Nice intensive care when she's there and everything, and there are times, she's constantly having breathing tubes put down her. Just seeing what she would go through is the hardest thing ever. It's not easy on any parent to see their child go through what they go in any medical situation. But we finally were told about a liver transplant that could help her be able to eat all these foods that she's always craved. It was a decision that took us a while to decide to do because we didn't know if it was the right one or not. Do we go through this and will she lose her life? Do we not go through it? And what if she has metabolic breakdown to where, you know, she has brain damage, and it leaves her in a situation where she needs even more care. You know, we finally spoke to her, and I told her the situation. I said, this is what they're offering you, is a liver transplant to be able to eat all these foods and live as what we can say a better normal life. I told her that she would have the say in if she wanted to do this. I didn't want to put her through something that maybe she didn't want to do. She started crying at that point, and I thought, oh my goodness, I told her something maybe she wasn't ready for. And she cried, and I was like, I'm sorry, maybe I shouldn't have told you. It's like, why are you crying? She goes, Mom, it's the happiest day of my life. She said, I can't believe I'm going to finally be able to eat all the things that I've been wanting to eat. The things that I would just either touch or smell, because that was my only way of knowing, you know, what it was like. So I finally made that call and told them that we were going to go through with it. She got the call that one day that there was a liver for her. We went in. She was scared, but she was very calm about it. And we thought this, you know, this is going to work. This is going to happen for her. She had her liver transplant in March of 2010. And within a month, we started seeing complications with her. One thing after another was going on with her, that we would go home and then they would tell us, no, you need to come back. This is going on. She ended up having, in 3.5 months that she spent in and out of the hospital after that first transplant, she had four major surgeries, and she ended up having 2 liver transplants. The second one was in June of 2010. Thankfully, after that second liver transplant, she did better. And even after that one, I think it took some time for her to even adjust to being able to eat all these new foods. When you see your child, or anyone for that matter, go to this restaurant, and for her it may feel like the very first time, and to see a menu and to look at all this food and sometimes not even know what all this food is because she's never even had it or even really heard of it. It's one of the greatest things, and it's something that a lot of us take for granted, you know. So for me, this is what we've been going through. Thankfully, now she's doing well, and, you know, she goes to school full-time now. And I'm, you know, really, really happy with the way things are now.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. So, Vanessa, what's your favorite food to eat?
My favorite food right now is French fries.
Okay, so I think this is a good time to introduce Dr. Willenbrink. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it, guys.
Yeah, that was great. I don't think I can follow that, but I'll just give it a try. My name is Holger Willenbrink. I'm also at UCSF, like Andrew. Andrew is in my laboratory in the Eli and Edith Broad Stem Cell Center at UCSF. I'm an associate professor in transplant at UCSF Department of Surgery. And I have devoted, I think, the last 15 years or so of my career to liver research, and in particular to liver cell therapy or liver stem cell-based therapies. As we heard, and I think as it's pretty obvious when we look at Vanessa, liver transplantation as a treatment for metabolic liver diseases or liver diseases per se works really well. So you may ask yourself, so why is that guy walking up to the microphone right now and talking about or trying to push the idea of spending money and effort on developing stem cell-based liver cell therapies. And the reason being is simply, I mean, there are others, but I think the main reason is that not every patient in need can get a liver currently because there's a long-standing donor liver shortage. And as Andrew pointed out very clearly in the beginning, actually many of the patients with liver disease don't require a whole organ replacement. Many of the patients would actually fare well or could be cured, like in the case of Vanessa, by replacing about 10 to 20% of the hepatocytes. And hepatocyte transplantation, so the infusion of isolated hepatocytes, actually works too. It has already been shown in 1998 by Strom and Fox from Pittsburgh that you can take hepatocytes from a liver that has been not utilized for transplantation by surgeons and infuse those cells into a patient. In that case, it was a Crigler-Najjar syndrome patient and restore liver function for a certain period of time and most importantly, also don't have any complications along the lines of safety. So hepatocyte transplantation works too, but unfortunately, hepatocyte transplantation hasn't become a clinical reality yet or is not really commonly practiced because it just competes with whole organ transplantation, which is so successful for the sparse donor organs. So that's where we come into the game. And so we and others have been looking for alternative sources for hepatocytes for liver cell therapy. And I just want to briefly touch on a couple of these things, and this is meant to maybe update you on the status of the field and along the lines what I think are critical requirements for any of those surrogate hepatocytes, those hepatocytes derived from alternative sources, to be providing, to be considered to be effective or enabling successful liver cell therapies. So the cells we currently considering in my lab and in many other labs in the United States and across the world are foremost pluripotent stem cells, so embryonic stem cells of human origin, induced pluripotent stem cells, and maybe more recently also the idea is emerging that you can convert a somatic cell by just providing the right mixture of genes into the cell type you're interested in our case into hepatocytes, which has some benefits or has some advantages that I hopefully we'll have time to talk about real quick. So like I said, this is a little update, and so the four criteria I want to use to provide this update, the four criteria for successful liver cell therapy are what the cell that you're going to infuse or the transplant of cells you're going to infuse or use, what it has to kind of meet, which demand it has to meet are, in my eyes, hepatocyte function, expandability after transplantation, safety, of course, and then that these cells are protected from rejection. So with regards to hepatocyte function, I think that's probably the most important criterion in this context. I think we've come a long way since the early days, and most of the data, most of the experience exists really with human embryonic stem cells. So we are using, like so many other labs, approaches that are mainly informed by how normal mouse development is orchestrated. So the growth factor knowledge we have is really derived from earlier studies in that model system. And we are involved in a collaboration with Mark Zern at UC Davis, which is funded by CIRM, by a CIRM Early Translational 2 grant, with the goal to develop the therapeutic potential of human ESL-derived hepatocytes. And I think we've made some progress along the way, and just recently, in fact, we I think, devised a protocol that produces ESL-derived hepatocytes that have most of the functions of primary human hepatocytes, and these functions are expressed at levels of about 10% or more overall. So we're pretty confident that these cells are pretty functional hepatocytes. However, when we put these cells into mice with liver failure, they typically don't perform very well because they seem to lack the ability to expand after transplantation, so they don't really divide, proliferate, and give rise to nodules, hence don't expand to a significant cell mass. And that leads me to the second point I want to touch on, which is expandability. I consider personally expandability a very important criterion for successful liver cell therapy, because if you think about the human liver, it contains about 250 billion hepatocytes. And like I said earlier, you have to replace about 10 to 20% of them to cure a disease like maple syrup urine disease. And so that's a lot of cells you have to get into the liver. And it's going to be very difficult to deliver these cells just by straightforward engraftment. So you really need to rely on some sort of expansion of the transplant mass after the transplantation process. And in fact, this is currently being pursued, for example, with primary human hepatocytes in Pittsburgh, where researchers, including Ira Fox, again, use localized liver irradiation to provide a selective growth advantage for the transplanted cells. So there are ways to do this, and you just need to have a cell population that can actually respond to these stimuli and expand after transplantation. And in addition to that, not only do you need expandability or the ability of the transplanted cells to proliferate after transplantation to establish the therapeutic cell mass, you also need it to maintain it. Otherwise, the cells are going to be outcompeted over time by the recipient's hepatocytes. So these are important criteria or important points also to consider. And the third point I want to touch on, or maybe I just want to briefly say from our experience or work in our lab, we think that we kind of might have found a way to provide this kind of ability or to have this ability to expand in the transplanted cells by just dialing back a little bit the differentiation. So it's really about finding the right balance between therapeutic hepatocyte function and retaining the ability to differentiate, which seems to be lost if you take the cells too far. And so the third point I wanted to touch on is safety, of course. And before I talk about that, I briefly want to mention one of the major concerns is really with ES or iPS cell-derived hepatocytes that you're co-transplanting cells that can give rise to teratomas, so undifferentiated cells that have not fully committed to hepatocyte differentiation. And a potential way out, maybe something has recently been emerging, which is direct reprogramming of somatic cells, let's say fibroblasts, into the desired cell type hepatocytes by just providing the right cocktail of genes that is able to induce the hepatocyte differentiation in these cells. So instead of growth factors, you just use genes, deliver them with, at this point, viral vectors also. And this process has been established by, or has been shown for the liver by Li Jian Hui from the Shanghai Institute of Biological Sciences, and we are collaborating as part of a CIRM-funded CIRM-ET3 effort with his group to take this into the human situation, and in particular with the emphasis on creating clinically safe or clinically suitable induced hepatocytes, that's what we call these cells, by A, having non-viral vectors for the gene delivery, and by B, identifying the human cell type that is most suitable for this reprogramming to hepatocyte process. And we have already obtained some data along these lines. So, for example, our human-induced hepatocytes seem to have the same ability to proliferate in vitro. So we haven't really done any in vivo experiments yet, but in vitro to proliferate, which is a major advantage compared to ES cell-derived hepatocytes. And having said all this, I really don't mean to say that ESL or iPSL-derived hepatocyte transplantation is not potentially a safe process. In fact, I think it can very well be a safe process because several technical means have evolved to purify these cells and so have transplants that could be considered safe. One way to do this is, of course, by fax, and antibodies exist where you can, which you can use to isolate specifically cells that have fully committed to hepatocyte differentiation, or antibodies exist where you can exclude the cells that have retained some pluripotency or undifferentiated in any other way. In addition, there are genetic approaches that you can use to just get rid of the cells that have not fully committed to hepatocyte differentiation. One way that seems to be working pretty well that has also been approved as a concept or as a technical strategy in the past by the FDA is using a viral thymidine kinase transgene. So you put the viral thymidine kinase transgene into your cell of interest, and then this allows you, if you, for example, put targeting sites for microRNA 122, which is a hepatocyte-specific microRNA, in tandem to this transgene, it allows you to eliminate every cell that has not committed to hepatocyte differentiation if you supply a drug, ganciclovir, because that drug is only going to be activated in cells that carry that transgene. And hepatocytes, because they express miR-122, will degrade the transgene at any time. So there are ways to definitely eliminate, not only before the transplant process, so before you infuse your ESCL-derived hepatocytes into patients, but also afterwards, these cells that have not fully committed or that are of potential danger to form tumors or masses. And finally, last but not least, I want to talk a little bit in the last couple of minutes about prevention of immune rejection. So there are various ways to tackle this, of course. I think most realistically, we're probably looking at ESL-derived hepatocytes in the nearest future. And there, of course, you're faced with the concept of allogeneic cells being rejected. And I think there are immune suppression protocols available. In particular, I think the researchers that have established or performing islet transplantation have really developed very robust, very effective protocols along these lines, which can be, I think, adopted for that purpose, for the hepatocyte transplantation purpose. Second of all, I think there are efforts underway to create banks of HLA-typed embryonic or iPS cell lines that could be useful for immune matching of a broad range of patients. And third, and definitely probably the most preferable, because it has the most potential to allow cell therapy, liver cell therapy, without the need of immune suppression, are iPS cells or directly converted hepatocytes from a patient's own cells, so autologous approaches. And here, I think a major advance has been made last year by the groups of Alan Bradley and Ludovic Valier in England. They showed that they can, not from a patient with maple syrup urine disease, but from a patient with alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, so another genetically encoded liver disease, that they can actually correct the genetic defect in the iPS cell lines by recombination, zinc finger enhanced recombination. So definitely, I think we're getting pretty close. All the pieces are coming together, and I'm very confident that in the future, these remaining hurdles that are now very clearly identified can be overcome, and that we will have ESCL, iPSL, or reprogrammed cell therapies for liver diseases for our patients. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Willenbring. Any questions? Dr. Lubin.
That was a wonderful presentation. Just out of curiosity, if a section of a normal liver is removed, doesn't the liver have an enormous amount of regenerative capacity?
Right.
And so why, when you put in some other, why can't that be conferred on other cells, or what's the mechanism of that?
It's absolutely correct, but they just have an equal kind of ability to proliferate. So if you put in some normal cells into a normal person's liver, the ability to divide is equal at best for the transplanted cells. So you will not have an overgrowth phenomenon, which you need to enhance the amount of transplanted cells. So let's say, realistically, you can maybe deposit a billion cells or so in a human liver, even with several infusions or so, but you need to reach maybe 25 billion or so. So you need a competitive growth advantage, and you can only achieve that if you kind of slow down the cell cycle of the recipient hepatocytes, which you can do, for example, with localized liver irradiation.
Dr. Farhan.
Can you see the day when antenatal diagnosis could be made and there could be a window of immune tolerance where, in fact, one could get cells almost into the late fetus, in which case essentially the disease could be cured without the need for immunosuppression?
I'm certainly no expert in immunology, but I definitely know also from efforts underway at UCSF along these lines, like prenatal transplantation, in that case with hematopoietic cells, that this is definitely a very promising avenue to achieve engraftment without the need for immune suppression, yeah, for sure.
Ms. Gibbons?
If it's okay, I have a question for Vanessa. Vanessa, first of all, thank you for making the supreme sacrifice of cutting class and being here with us today, bringing your mom and dad along. Very, very generous of you. You're quite the warrior, and you've been through a lot. You've faced a lot. You must have a lot of courage. It's obvious you're really brave. What do your friends know about your transplant? And, you know, are you at school? Do they know, oh, that's the girl with the new liver? Or what do they know about it?
They just know that I'm the one that had the transplant and that, like, they have to be sometimes careful still.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, like, sometimes I could be very sensitive to what they say and all.
But I bet you're teaching them a lot.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. When you would eat foods that you, like your mom was saying she was afraid you were going to have a forbidden food that was going to react badly mm-hmm. with you and that your liver couldn't process, what did you feel like? How sick did you get?
I was pretty sick to the point where sometimes I wasn't able to walk and I felt scared.
So it would make you weak and sick to your stomach? You were
yes.
vomiting, all that?
Yes.
Wow. You must love your doctors. Right?
Yes.
Well, I'm sure they love you. Wow, you guys did a great job. I didn't know anything about all this, so thank you for helping to educate us.
You're welcome.
Any other comments or questions? Mike on, Mr. Sheehan.
I just wanted to ask about some of your other work. You recently published on colorectal carcinoma. Just a sense, I mean, it was very interesting work. What is the therapeutic kind of timeline? It seemed like you'd actually identified a lot of the cause of that disease. Relatively rare liver cancer.
Oh, you mean for...
For the colorectal okay. carcinoma. You just published, I think you published on that about...
Yeah.
6 months ago.
Yeah, yeah.
We
showed that hepatocytes can give rise to biliary cancer, which is kind of surprising, but maybe not because they're developmentally related. So both hepatocytes and biliary cells originate from the same progenitor in utero. And I think, I guess our findings are fairly preliminary, but they highlighted two new signaling pathways in the process, so we were able to induce this, to create the cancer, basically. And those signaling pathways are now pursued by a collaborator, I think together with Genentech, whether or not those could be new therapeutic targets for that disease, for which basically there is currently no cure other than surgery.
Now I'm aware of that, and if you're late stage, there's nothing. There's no drugs.
Right.
How would one keep up with what's going on with that? I mean, does it seem like they might identify a druggable target and potential?
Well, they're definitely working on it. So they're actually already testing drugs. So the beauty is that drugs already were available for AKT and notch signaling at that company, and so they're already testing these. I heard in the mouse model.
And this is at Genentech?
Yeah, Genentech has the drugs, and our collaborator, her name is Xin Shen. She's at UCSF.
Could I maybe follow up with you on that, maybe?
Yeah, absolutely.
Outside the meeting.
Dr. Stewart, could I ask you to briefly summarize the way that CIRM funding has sort of helped all this along, and in your lab in particular?
I think my lab would be belly up without CIRM. That's, of course, a joke. But no, I like somebody said in the beginning... I certainly didn't. So I came from OHSU to UCSF in the end of 2005, and I was working on adult stem cells. So it's not that I didn't work on stem cells, but I definitely didn't have any exposure to embryonic stem cells. And the CIRM seed grant definitely kind of was geared towards, I think, at least that's how I see it, people like me with a certain kind of expertise, certain desire to develop treatments, to maybe consider or facilitate at least considering and using and getting to know embryonic stem cells. And I have since become a fan and a real believer of pluripotent stem cells. And I have... we have very little adult stem cell work going on in our lab. I'm not saying that it's not working or it's not worthwhile pursuing, but I definitely, just simply because of the reason I mentioned earlier that the liver has 250 billion hepatocytes in humans, it's just a numbers game. It's just about efficiency. It's just about making enough cells, and I don't know any adult stem cell that can pull it off. So that's how we got into that, and that's kind of one thing led to the other. And I'm actually very grateful that I haven't seen any patients for 10 years, but I haven't been a pediatrician myself like Andrew, that I have an opportunity maybe to, within my career, also see this come to fruition and being applied in patients maybe in a not-so-far future.
Dr. Dulage.
Yes, thank you. You have very nicely highlighted all the challenges and the various pieces of the puzzle that you try to move ahead. Of all of these, what is the next, your hope for the next breakthrough? What will be the next key milestone that you hope to reach and will get closer to your goal of helping patients directly?
So I think the next breakthrough is really kind of what I alluded to a little bit. So in my field, we are blessed and cursed at the same time with mouse models that are very unforgiving. So either the cells can do it or they can't. And so I think the field is just basically waiting for somebody to have the right protocol, like I said, where the cells are mature, they provide therapeutic function, but they retain the ability to expand and repopulate that mouse's liver. And I think when that has been achieved, we're ready to go really quick towards application. But everybody is kind of really waiting for that. It's going to happen. I think there's signs now, and like I said, we have data also along these lines, and it has been a while. I mean, Bill have been working on this now for 5 years or so, but I think it's going to happen pretty soon.
Congratulations, then.
Thank you, Dr. Willenbrink. Thank you, Dr. Grimm. And thank you, Veronica, Vanessa. We like French fries, too. So thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.